as I said, we're very pleased to have Dr. Rim and Pete to join us, and I wanted to do an outline starting this month with endocrinology as the subject, and I wanted to just to outline the nervous system as a whole, and then we're going to get into Parkinson's disease and Parkinsonism and a few of the other little subsets that are similar as an introduction to the endocrine system. And then maybe next month we'll get into the pituitary. I know we've mentioned a lot about thyroid hormones, and Dr. Pete's his main speciality is hormone physiology. So, and then the thymus, the adrenals, pancreas, ovaries and testes as other sources of hormones, and how they affect health, and how everything that we do can consciously interact for good or bad with our health. We're not at the mercy of anything in particular. We make choices. And so each one of us, just by hearing and listening, and then going ahead and reading and seeing the facts and the science, people can find further information to support everything Dr. Pete's been shouting from the rooftops for the last 30, 40 years. So are you there, Dr. Pete?
Yes.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. So I wanted to try to explore the endocrine system in a large topic, I know, but one I feel would be a useful exercise in understanding physiology from your perspective, Dr. Pete. And you make regular mention of pioneering scientists whose works give a better appreciation of the physiological processes occurring in the body and often provide a new direction away from the hijacked modern scientific theories we're cultured to accept, a lot of which are a Pandora's box of ever-increasing drug dependencies, and conspiracies abound along with that train of thought. Given we are truly complex organisms with a network of communication systems and feedback, either positive or negative, to that input, the pathways through which these signals travel, as well as the structures which respond to the signals and the signals which ultimately affect another system, all need to be cohesively organized. So any deficit, however small, can have far-reaching and dramatic consequences, and it is true that the organism will do everything possible to correct or mitigate disease before failing, sometimes resulting in disease processes that take decades to end in death. And so communication systems and appropriate responses are key to good health and functioning. And this is the role of the endocrine system I want to explore with you, Dr. Pete. The earliest records of recognizing the role, and it may be earlier than this, but the earliest records that I found during my last 2 days or so getting material together for the show was the Chinese pulling out isolated sex and pituitary hormones from human urine in 200 BC, for crying out loud. So that's certainly food for thought when we think we know everything that we know now, with ICP, MS and other mass spectrometry being the kind of leading investigative machinery. So, and then obviously the ancient Greeks and the Romans, from Aristotle, Hippocrates and Galen, and where we get our herbal medicine background from, until the emergence of the germ theory. And I know you mentioned this a lot in the 19th century then, and this is, I think, is perhaps where it just veered off of normality and common sense and it's a real true scientific endeavor. That's where it kind of just veered off the rails, and I think we've carried on in that vein ever since. And I know that your whole philosophy has been about challenging mainstream science for science's sake, because it's not very scientific. And I think in that regard, Dr. Pete, would you mind giving an overview of the basis of understanding disease past to present, and how this has formed our approach to its management, and how your rationale differs?
I see it as a deviation from the Chinese and the Greeks, who had a pretty unified picture of what an organism is. Aristotle actually was pretty much an organicist in his understanding of the organism. And it was really around the time of Descartes, middle of the early part of the 17th century, when the things really got formalized on the wrong track. Descartes described the organism as a machine completely separate from consciousness. Consciousness was guiding the machine possibly from some contact point in the brain. But under the ground, mostly people who were persecuted by the monarchies and such, they continued to think along the organic, unified understanding of what an animal or a person is. But following Descartes, the organism was seen as made up of parts, just like a steam engine or a clock. Each part could be defined and understood and mechanically interlocked with the other parts, and the consciousness or the soul was seen as something completely separate from this machine and could somehow sometimes interfere with its operation, but mostly it was out of our control, simply running according to causal determinism. And when the idea of infection, something from the environment causing a disease, came in, it happened that the use of the microscope had developed to the point that people had seen the compartments in plants, and they called the compartments cells. When the plant dried up, it left the cellulose framework, empty little chambers, which they called cells, while a more underground approach looked at particles like red blood cells and called the units corpuscles, little bodies, rather than empty compartments. And this idea of breaking the organism down into cells and seeing those as parts of a machine made up of material without consciousness or spirit. This became the background for seeing a disease as particular mechanical interference with the operation of the machine.
And this is where the term reductionism came from, right? Or reductionist medicine?
And the disease, one line of thinking was that it was a particular little particle of evil material, a germ cell, analogous to the cells that make up the machine. So it was a material particle interfering with our material particles that became identified as a disease, a very concrete, specific interference with the machine. And as people looked more closely at tumors, they saw really it was a matter of organization rather than some particular concrete change or substance. But this idea of organization took about 150 years to finally catch on. Right up until the beginning of this century, people were still stuck on Descartes' picture of a mechanical organism being interrupted by something right down on the cellular level, or even smaller, the molecular level. So the cancer was defined as an evil cell, a mutant cell containing bad genetic material, defective DNA. So all you had to do in the case of a germ-caused disease, all you had to do was kill the germ, and you were cured. In the case of the cancer interpreted as a mutant cell, all you had to do was eliminate every single individual mutant cell, and the disease would be cured.
Well, I mean, that's still how they treat cancer now, isn't it? I mean, to some degree.
Almost everyone is still stuck in this 17th century idea of what an organism is and what a disease is. And Parkinson's disease, even though in the 19th century, people recognized all the symptoms of the disease, stiffness, generally, the older a person is, the more Parkinson's traits they have, stiffness, wobbly tremor, and slowness of movement. All of the extreme old age symptoms are simply coming on stronger and earlier when they call it Parkinson's disease. But by the latter part of the 19th century, people had noticed that people suffering from this so-called disease, if they took a long train ride to get to the doctor, their symptoms might disappear. Or if they came on a carriage or rode a horse, their symptoms were greatly alleviated by just moving around through space. And so some people proposed a vibration therapy. About 40 years ago, someone noticed that swimming alleviated the symptoms. So simply a different kind of stimulation could reverse the symptoms. And it turns out that in animals, you can create the disease by poisoning them. Yep. And by giving them an enriched environment, you can reverse the actual anatomical, chemical changes of their nervous system.
So in the poisoned animals, if you place them in an enriched environment, you're saying that they no longer display the...
Yeah, similar to what they noticed in people who took a long train ride.
Okay, so to continue, Dr. P, I wanted to explore Parkinson's disease and Parkinsonism, as there's several different similar related type situations that may not necessarily be Parkinson's per se, but it does actually seem to be a fairly woolly kind of construct in terms of the multitude of various symptoms that can be expressed, some of which may start early, some of which may just be late onset. But basically, they go over the mechanism that's discussed today about the disease and its treatment, and highlight your approach to this condition later on to understand it the way you do. So the terms used to describe long-term degenerative disorder of the central nervous system affecting mainly the motor system, but which can involve the sensory system, with cognitive and sleep and mood disturbances also noted as part of the picture. There's a compound here, and I know we talked about this the other day, alpha-synuclein, a compound present in these so-called Lewy bodies that are present under microscopic examination, found within the substantia nigra.
In the brain, right?
Yeah, as well as several other brain regions, and they are diagnostic for Parkinson's disease. So several Parkinson's genes are involved, and they've been highlighted here. I'd like to pick your brains about some of those as we go on through this, but so far as the functioning of waste product digesting lysosomes that may be linked to the inability to break down alpha-synuclein, there's a protein also called dardarin. Now, the primary symptoms of Parkinson's result from the loss of dopamine-secreting cells within the substantia nigra. And there are five major pathways in the brain that we know now. There may be more, but there were five when I was studying, connecting other brain areas with the basal ganglia. These are the motor, so this is a movement, ocular motor, where the eyes will track the hands, or the eye movement will track the movement externally. The associative, the limbic, and the orbitofrontal circuits. Now, all of them are disrupted, essentially, and this disruption explains the many varied presentations of the disease. So, in terms of how you understand the nervous system and physiology, just to start with the motor circuit and how higher brainstem functions interact through nerves to elicit muscular contraction, for example, because we'll talk about the tremor of Parkinson's disease and we'll go on later to describe some of the drugs and treatments that can be used, but they are also responsible chronically for the same symptoms, such that it's almost a worse outcome than the initial outcome, so it's not a particularly successful treatment. But in terms of the motor system, or the nervous system, and the various drugs, second messengers, etc., that exert those controls, how do you see this motor circuit working in the body, and how would you perhaps be able to rationalise an alternative approach to the treatment of Parkinson's disease, given how you know?
My orientation is very similar to Pavlov's, who saw the motor system as subordinate to the sensory system. He saw the cortex of the brain as primarily an extension of the sense organs, and that this formed the environment for the motor reflexes. The idea of a reflex is another thing that originated with Descartes and is simply wrong. The cells aren't mechanically connected in reflex patterns. One of the first people in the West to analyze this carefully was the French existentialist, so-called philosopher, Merleau-Ponty, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who analyzed the meaning of reflexes. And he clearly shows that there are no reflexes in the Cartesian sense. And if you attend a neurology course, you'll probably find people still arguing that there are simple innate mechanical reflexes in the Descartes sense. Mm-hmm. And for example, the linguistics system of Noam Chomsky is based entirely on this primitive false idea of the brain function based on mechanical reflexes, and it simply doesn't work. Merleau-Ponty is probably the person who most clearly explains the problems with it, but in the Pavlovian picture, as especially developed through the 1950s and 60s by his student P.K. Anokhin, the sensory system is fluid and continuously being revised as the organism explores its environment. And so the sense of exploring and being stimulated by newness, the idea of traveling through time and space, is in charge overriding defects in the motor system.
Interesting.
That's the relevant picture, I think, for seeing disease, especially Parkinson's disease, in a non-mechanical way. Protein you mentioned, dardrin. The interesting thing about it is that it shows up as a defect in Crohn's disease in the intestine, as well as in Parkinson's disease. And Parkinson's typically starts with constipation. And in 19th century medicine, people remembered the intestine as well as the brain in treating disease. It was very common to diagnose death as a result of inflammation of the bowel, which pathologists typically overlook as just a side issue. But the intestine was recognized as very important, and the brain as the other end of the organism, that sort of the two dimensions.
And now doctors are taught that if you have a bowel movement 3 times a day or once every 3 days, it's all normal.
And when you trace out the chemical links between what's going wrong in the intestine and in the rest of the motor system, the behavioral system, and so on, you can see links, but they're always contextually working. There is no simple pathogenic chemical in the intestine, but the bacteria living in the intestine, the food you eat, and the way your intestine responds to it.
And the stress you're exposed to.
Yeah. These act in the activating part of the brain. Around 1950, a part of the brain called the reticular activating system was identified.
Mm-hmm.
And this includes the region where the substantia nigra and the basal ganglia are. Mm-hmm. And this is where sensory input is dished out to activate the upper parts of the brain. And when that's happening, it tends to go with an inhibitory effect on the body. So the stronger your mentality is dreaming, for example,
mm-hmm.
The more relaxed your body tends to be. And in Parkinson's, the system, it really tends to be overactivated, unable to relax properly. And so a characteristic thing is that during sleep and dreams, the person who is developing Parkinson's disease doesn't relax properly. The body, if they have a dream, they might scream and thrash around and hit people. There's a failure of consciousness to override and relax the body.
Now, can I just take you back to what you said a moment ago about, and it reminds me of inescapable stress and the rat experiments, and that being countered by the environmental enrichment that you said could totally restore a Parkinson's created or induced effect in a mouse that was put into a environmental enrichment situation and actually lost the symptoms. Are you? I know that one does not directly causatively cure the other, but you were saying here that there's a link between environmental enrichment and the progressive replacement of what can we call it? Something substantially good that offsets the negative effects of the inflammation, the degradation, the slowing of the bowel, endotoxin release, etc., reabsorption, and that this is a definite key feature. That you think it could be definitely as part of a holistic program. Sure, I can understand that would be very plausible to suggest something like that. But is that where you were going to?
The PK Anokhin, mm-hmm. and all of the people in the Pavlovian tradition see a global event or process in the brain that they called the acceptor of action.
Mm-hmm.
It's our intention and expectation in the world.
Right.
And this is what is integrating mm-hmm. not only the motor system and dominating the so-called reflexes, mm-hmm. but this process, which is it's like a model of everything we know and intend to do in the world. This is supported in the organism, not just in the brain, but it's a process involving sensory nerves from the whole body. And this process in the brain, it sort of... During daytime, at least, it's based on our inner ear balance system,
okay.
The vestibular system. And this, it's a unified picture of the world and the organism. And this process itself of being conscious is involved in the activation of not only the endocrine glands throughout the body, but in the nerves themselves as they are supporting this model of the world or acceptor of action in the process of metabolizing to be conscious. They are making changes internally that involves, for example, synthesizing, turning energy substances, sugar, for example, into cholesterol, and turning cholesterol into pregnenolone, right? In the nerves, for example, of the substantia nigra.
Right.
This process is going on, energy, sugar, cholesterol, pregnenolone, progesterone, and the endocrine process, which is then stabilizing the structure and the consciousness so that the flavor of your consciousness, when it's successful, is modified by the balance you have between your progesterone, DHEA, and other steroids, and the energy processes.
So can you try to explain, like, the personality that you're saying in people that develop Parkinson's, they're not
getting... They're experiencing learned helplessness, I think. The way they live, they have incorporated duties, obligations, and such that they can manage very well, but they aren't overcoming the stress adequately.
Because they're not exploring new things, or they don't have new input to their brain. It's just the same old treadmill they're on, or
they're stuck in a way so that they aren't getting enough
sensory input
stimulation. Yeah.
That's so interesting because I think when you read the regular texts, medical texts about Parkinson's, and they go through the plethora of symptoms, one of them, symptom most characteristic, I think, is fairly emotionless expressions on the patients with Parkinson's, not enthused, difficult to engage, don't have any kind of... what can I say? Any kind of joie de vivre, I don't know how else to say it, apart from the French way, any kind of joy of life. But that's very much part of a learned helplessness type construct that would cause an organism then to just see things just within the boundaries of what they have and then not be anything new and stimulating them. And that stimulation, you're saying, is very much part of switching on what is a totally holistic approach to Parkinson's outside of the mechanistic view that the regular science has. And we'll go through the drugs because the drugs are really not effective at all. And they work very mechanistically, and they actually cause typically more problems than they're seeking to address.
So are you saying new sensory output will, for example... new sensory input will, for example, increase the dopamine output from the substantia nigra in the brain?
Or the protective progesterone, pregnenolone.
Or the hormones that protect against those cells degrading, not producing dopamine.
Yeah, the dopamine theory, it's really part, you have to look at it in the history. At the beginning of the 20th century, with the mechanistic view, they were seeing the brain as a mechanical thing which was having defects causing the tremor, and they actually started cutting out parts of the brain to remove the tremor.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a good idea, doesn't it?
The man who invented the word cybernetics, Norbert Wiener, he proposed the best surgery up to that time instead of cutting out parts of the cortex, which they had been doing in the 1930s, they were focusing on the brainstem, and he designed the radar searching self-control systems that would focus on an airplane and aim a gun. This feedback system, he saw the brain having tremors, his radar gun aiming system, if it was poorly aligned, would have a tremor, a searching movement back and forth. So he saw the tremor as a feedback searching process.
Right.
And so he suggested what he would do to his radar apparatus was to knock out part of the sensitivity. So he suggested a surgery to cut out part of the searching feedback apparatus,
yep.
And it actually worked better than the grosser surgeries. And it's been done right down to the 70s and 80s. They were still simply ablating or destroying part of the brain. Then they got a little more refined and started stimulating it. But sometimes that didn't work, like Michael Fox said that he wasn't going to have any more surgical treatments because instead of stopping the tremor of his left side, it started to tremor in the right side.
Yeah. Well, that's the issue, isn't it? Well, I guess we'll get into some of the medications now, just to bring them out and to explain the mechanistic view that was constructed to support the use of these drugs. But, okay, so the substantia nigra is part of the brain here that we're focusing on in Parkinson's that is the site of dopamine production. Now, dopamine is... I think I understand this right, but I think the nervous system is pretty much wanting to be firing fairly constantly, and the dopamine actually controls that from happening ad hoc so that you don't get these sudden jerks, etc., and that dopamine allows, through this inhibition, the ordered movement of muscles in coordinated patterns. It's not a stimulant, per se. And
well, it's integrated with the inhibiting systems. So
it's much more of a relaxant.
Yeah, in itself, it is an activator, but it runs into nerves that feed back with an inhibition.
Right. So when somebody, for example, I think L-DOPA is supposedly the gold standard, for want of a better word, of treatment, and that within 5 years, most patients using L-DOPA as the replacement for dopamine, because dopamine doesn't cross the blood-brain barrier, as far as I know, but L-DOPA does, and within the brain, L-DOPA is converted into dopamine and then has an action directly. But the long-term effects of L-DOPA are a condition called bradykinesia, where there's involuntary movements like there is in a fine tremor, a resting tremor, because, again, there's a differentiation, I guess, without getting too medical, there's a difference between intention tremors and resting tremors. So resting tremors are typically something you could see in a Parkinson's patients with either the leg tremoring or the hand tremoring in a pill-rolling fashion. I always remember this from studying, but they talk about pill-rolling tremor as one of the hallmark signs of classical Parkinson's. So supplying somebody with L-DOPA to treat that tremor does initially have a positive beneficial effect. But how is it, I wonder, that the administration of dopamine over a chronic period of 3, 4, 5 years actually causes worse symptoms than the tremor for which it was prescribed? And most patients that use L-DOPA are in worse shape 5 years down the road than they are if they weren't treated.
I think the problem is that the whole theory of what L-DOPA and dopamine are doing is mechanistic and mistaken.
And so they're just patching. They're just putting a little Band-Aid on it. They're not treating the sensory input deficiency.
Another drug that is approved for use in Parkinson's is amantadine or memantine more recently. And in the 19th century, they were already using belladonna and hyoscyamine anticholinergics to treat the tremors.
Okay.
And they were pretty effective and didn't have the bad side effects of increasing rigidity and so on that L-DOPA does. And the it turns out that these amantadine and memantine have the anticholinergic, anti-excitatory effects, but they are also anti-excitatory in the glutamatergic system. Glutamate and cholinergic systems are both very powerful excitatory, and the glutamate system ends up producing nitric oxide.
Okay.
And the amantadine and anticholinergics, memantine, are not only stopping the excitation that is part of the tremor, but they end up lowering the exposure to nitric oxide. And nitric oxide is a chronic stress-induced factor in suppressing mitochondrial respiration and energy production and accelerating aging of the brain.
Mm-hmm.
Using these approved drugs is it actually is giving insight into what's going on to a much more global organismic process rather than just restoring the lost so-called dopamine regulatory system. It's restoring energy processes, reducing the effects of stress in a systematic way.
Okay, you're listening to Ask Your Herb, Dr. Kamie D. Garraville, 91.1 FM. From now until the end of the show, you're invited to call in with any questions about this subject of endocrinology and Parkinson's disease. If you live in the area, the temporary number for the 707 region is 383-9007, and the 800 number is 800-568-3723. So I see the lights flashing here, so let's take the first call and see where we're going. Caller, you're on the air, and what's your question?
Hi, I'm from the San Francisco Bay Area.
Hi,
and I was wondering, are there simple things that someone can do, like a stepping stone to get out of learned helplessness for, you know, for people that are overcoming hypothyroidism and still find it overwhelming to do big tasks or big things?
What was the very first thing you said, a stepping stone
to get out of the learned helplessness?
Dr. P, do you think there is a progressive course that can be followed to get out?
Yeah,
of...
or what do you suggest to increase sensory input to the brain?
Oh,
and to help get out of the learned helplessness.
Painting,
behavioral things like going new places, meeting new people, doing very different things that you've never done before but thought you might enjoy doing, at the same time as you try to correct your energy processes that are suppressed, having more enjoyable, more varied meals, for example, and making sure that your thyroid function is good.
I know you told me when I asked you what was it, one of the best things I could teach our daughter, or what's a good education for our daughter, and you said introduce her to new people, and she loves to meet new people, and she gets so fired up.
Okay, so Dr. P, I think just on the basis of that last call, in terms of new things, I mean, I think arguably everybody would, most people, let's not say everybody, that's too all-inclusive, people, I think, have a bucket list of 20 things they'd like to do, you know, whether it's jumping out of an aircraft and, with a parachute and, just fast things or exciting things or going to new places. I think outside of the scope of that, because most people probably think they can't afford it or they don't have the time for it, how do you think about creative outlets like painting and or constructing poetry or...
As long as that's not something you do every day anyway.
As long as it's not something you do every day, yeah. I'm just thinking of it as a construct that would be maybe more easily attained rather than...
Dr. Pete doesn't want to give a prescription here, I can tell that.
Yeah, doing something unexpected out of the routine.
Mm-hmm.
Some people quit their job and learn a new profession or yeah. new trade.
Yeah. Okay, let's get into some of the things that I'd spoken with you about earlier that were things that are in keeping with the whole anti-inflammatory process that you're saying is all part and parcel of this breakdown. So I guess mitochondrial function, I'm getting pretty interested about the whole approach to supporting mitochondria and whether it's coenzyme Q10 or other kind of new nootropics and things like that. I know you're not particularly keen on nootropics and drugs that supposedly enhance mental function and or mitochondrial function because you don't really put a lot of value to it. But in terms of mitochondria and their obvious role in energy production and how energy in the body is at the root of paying for all the transactions, how do you feel about mitochondrial support in the approach to a Parkinson's patient?
Getting good rest is part of the support. Stopping unnecessary excitatory stimulation. Good stimulation should be fun rather than stressful. And
so not jumping out of an aircraft.
Well, unless you find that fun.
That's stressful, probably.
Riding a roller coaster, I mean, that might be a little bit stressful. It's fun, right?
Yeah, everything that is anti-inflammatory can be relaxing as well as stimulating. Caffeine is extremely protective against all of the defects in Parkinson's disease. It activates while protecting the mitochondria. Gamma hydroxybutyrate, which is in some plants, yeah. like
passion flower?
The tropical fruit, what's it called?
I wonder if it's.
Wait, you're not. He was thinking you meant GABA.
An activator, gamma hydroxybutyrate.
Okay, well, the passion fruit or the liliqui or what else you call it?
Passion fruit is
the other name.
I was looking for.
Yeah, I thought it might be, but I didn't want to jump in there.
Grenadilla, I think it's another name for it.
It's something we make along with GABA, which helps to eliminate stressful overexcitation. The synuclein, which is one of the things that goes wrong and is damaged in Parkinson's disease, it happens to have the same effect as rotenone, the toxic thing that has been seen to cause something exactly like Parkinson's disease by blocking the complex one of the mitochondrion.
So then all of the herbs that act on the GABA would be useful, you're saying?
Yeah. Even cannabis has been, because of its sedative effects, it can be protective against the toxic types of overstimulation.
And what about alcohol?
I think it's antioxidant, can be anti-inflammatory, and can be, in the right circumstance, it can be anti-Parkinson's.
Now, how about this? The nicotine, as I've seen a fair amount of research showing that nicotine is actually protective, significantly protective against Parkinson's in a big study that's been done.
I think the population effect where they see that smokers have somewhat protection against Parkinson's, I think part of that effect is that it relieves constipation. It activates the intestine, and that in itself has an anti-inflammatory, antitoxic effect.
Interesting. Okay,
so what do you think is the best method for delivery of nicotine, like making a tea out of, I mean, it's not...
I think either absorbing it through the skin in the form of an ointment, or ingesting very small amounts of the leaf, tobacco leaf.
Very, very quickly, I think while we're talking about tobacco, I read an article today that's now saying that the vaping craze that's really starting to take off and reintroduce smoking to a younger generation is actually showing up with some fairly disturbing health effects. It's kind of early days yet for the research to come through, but they're actually saying that even it could be even some even worse side effects to vaping than there would have been to smoking, obtaining nicotine that way. So nicotine in its own right is not, it's a neurotoxin for sure, but it's not a good molecule, but it's not the poisonous component in tobacco smoke. It's mainly the carcinogens, correct, and the tar. But nicotine can have some therapeutic effects.
And keeping the intestine healthy because of the when endotoxin in itself reaches the nervous system, it locally as well as systemically activates processes that lead to the same blockage of mitochondrial respiration that rotenone does, or that ionizing radiation does in a chronic sense. Having CAT scans of the head, I think, is probably part of the reason that Parkinson's prevalence has increased so greatly over the last 20 or 30 years.
Because they're pretty keen to give you CAT scans for anything now.
Yeah.
Oh, well, it's a shame. But I'm hopeful that in time, things far less damaging will become more commonplace, a little bit like the switch in attitudes towards saturated fats from the long-protected polyunsaturates that have been shown to do so much damage. Now, how about...
Aspirin is another thing, mentioning the polyunsaturated fats. One of the prostaglandins produced in substantia nigra is very toxic to the brain, and simply having a regular use of aspirin will protect against that prostaglandin made from the polyunsaturated fats.
Okay.
And the breakdown of the polyunsaturated fats, acrolein, is a very toxic material that we produce internally from the polyunsaturates. And that is one of the things that turns synuclein into a toxic fibrous material, sort of like the prions in mad cow disease.
Interesting. Because now, what do you think about this concept that the... I think I was reading that they haven't actually proved beyond a doubt that these Lewy bodies, which do show up in the substantia on microscopical evaluation, they may have a protective role. I mean, I think they've made them pathognomic and kind of diagnostic for confirming Parkinson's, but they may actually have a kind of a protective role. And
I think the body might be parking to get out of the way some of these synuclein fibrils and packing them up in little compartments that are relatively safe. But some of the toxic fibrils of synuclein are known to be passed from one cell to another, causing a damage to the cell that receives it.
Well,
I wanted to ask you, Dr. Pete, when you were talking about this rapid movement and dream state, you know, for people who are developing Parkinson's, or what about people who've had that for years and years and years? Is that not also a symptom of low thyroid because their muscles just can't relax, or is it the brain that can't relax? So I'm trying to understand that a little bit better.
It's the same thing. Nothing in the body can relax fully when your thyroid function is low. That's one of the funny things that came out of the idea of the cell as a compartment enclosed in a membrane, if you think of it as a corpuscle that has to be in a state ready to work when it's rested, the state where it's ready to perform its job is a high energy state, and that's the well-rested state, full of energy, ready to go. If you don't have enough of the thyroid and glucose and oxygen, whatever, to produce the energy, you stay in a semi-contracted, excited state. So what happens in Parkinson's is this reaches a chronically deadly cell-killing condition. In chronic hypothyroidism, it's simply a nuisance that your sleep isn't as restful as it should be. You can't get into the deep, relaxing, restorative sleep because you don't have enough energy. So the cells are not ready to work. They haven't accumulated the energy and structure needed to do a proper job. And so they keep churning through the energy-producing process without relaxing and storing up the energy as glycogen, ATP, creatine phosphate, and so on.
Okay. Well, I know there was more questions surrounding things like the monoamine oxidase inhibitors, the A and B inhibitors, and how they have been used with varying degrees. But ultimately, this condition doesn't have any real course of action for it other than trying to offset the symptoms as long as possible, followed by palliative care. I would very much like to carry on this subject next month, just to break down some of the things that are definitely shown, like lack of testosterone is definitely shown and ameliorates, makes better the symptoms of Parkinson's. Reducing estrogen, because estrogen is kind of very inflammatory and kind of anti-restful type molecule. I know there were plenty of other things, and as usual, I'm sorry, we only got one call. I didn't really plug too much for people to come on the air, but I kind of been a little bit selfish this month. Maybe next month, if you're able, would you be willing to carry on with this?
Oh, yeah.
Great. I really appreciate that. Well, for those people who've listened to the show, thanks so much for your time, Dr. Pete.
Okay, thank you.
For those people who've listened to the show, thanks so much for either calling in like you have and or listening. We know that I get such a lot of feedback from people. I get it every week from people. They just write me and they come from all over, not just a guy from Norway or, you know,
Finland.
Finland, yeah. They come from all over. So I get emails from people from the UK. I get them from South America. I get them from Asia even, you know. So they listen all over the world. And I think it's very important that it's a resource that we freely make available. KMUD makes it available for you to download this podcast after that show hours on the audio archive. And on our website, I'm compiling what's turning out to be a pretty big compendium of Dr. Pete shows. So until the third Friday of next month, we'll carry on with endocrinology as a bigger section anyway, going over all the rest of it in the months to come. But we'll try and wrap up the Parkinson's debate next month. I know Dr. Pete has other suggestions that we didn't even get into. My name's Andrew Murray.
My name's Sarah Johannesson Murray.